Hey, folks, and welcome to the Deconstructor of Fun podcast. Your host today, Mishka Katkov, and the topic of the day is the evolution of Israel's gaming ecosystem. As guests, we have none other than Gigi Levi-Weiss, founding partner of NFX, early investor into Plarium, Playtika, among numerous other startups. And we are going to focus on Israel's gaming ecosystem because it's known for massive gaming sector. Playtika, Monactive, Plarium, Crazy Labs, IronSource, AppsFlyer, Fiber, just to mention a few of these amazing companies that are growing quarter over quarter, day over day. And what makes Tel Aviv very interesting is that the city did not have a booming gaming sector or any kind of gaming sector 20 years ago, unlike many other cities such as Barcelona, London, San Francisco, LA, Helsinki. So it kind of came out of nowhere to being what it is today. And in this podcast, we're going to naturally make a lot of comparisons between Helsinki, since that's very familiar to me, as well as San Francisco and Tel Aviv. So all great cities for making games. And I think this is an awesome podcast for you guys to listen, because no matter where you're coming from, there's a lot of learnings on how to foster this sort of a creative, data-driven, just amazing gaming sector in your city. So hope you enjoy this podcast. I truly enjoyed recording it. And as always, without further ado, shout out to our amazing sponsors.
I think what's become clearer, certainly in the last few years, as competition in the game industry has really stepped up, is that there's a fundamental difference between a great game and a great game business. You know, you could be super lucky, your game is an instant hit, it's resonating with users, but for when that's not the case, or even when you just want to take your game growth to the next level, that's where we come in. So we've developed a really incredible platform that's designed to make you as powerful and as capable as possible in growing your game, whether that's growing your game revenue or growing your user base.
That was Melissa Zeloff from IronSource, arguably the best growth platform for games on mobile. We all know it. Mobile marketing is going through a paradigm shift. With the industry moving towards a more aggregate way of measuring marketing efforts, marketers' ability to measure and understand the impact of their marketing investments is further curtailed. AppsFlyer, though, is not sitting on the sidelines. The company has set a goal to help their customers and the entire mobile ecosystem to successfully navigate the new era of mobile marketing. And that's where AppsFlyer's latest product, the Incrementality Solution, comes to play. It's a product that truly empowers marketers to gain a better understanding of the real value that their marketing efforts hold. AppsFlyer's incrementality solution is built around remarketing. It simplifies the process of designing, executing, and analyzing incremental lift tests at scale, which previously was something that only the biggest players on the market were able to do. With incrementality, marketers can focus on the end goal of their test without actually having to worry about the heavy lifting that comes with it. To learn more about incrementality and to read the success stories from publishers like Kabam, I suggest that you head out to appsflyers.com.
Welcome to the Deconstructive Podcast, Gigi. This is your second time. We just did an episode with you, Christian, and Travis Boatman. And that was a fantastic discussion on how to scale a company. So if the guys haven't listened to it, really suggest going back to it. And as an introduction of you, you're a founding partner of NFX, basically a leading Israeli and Silicon Valley VC fund, and also early investors in multiple different things. But for our type of audience, so that they understand, Plarium and Playtika are among the startups you have invested early on. And actually, I believe you founded Playtika, if I'm correct.
I was one of the three co-founders of Playtika. I was a chairman. I didn't really work in the company full time, but I was a chairman, and I was one of the first investors in Plarium. I was one of the first investors in Moonactive. And then in probably another 15 games companies, Rising Tide and Space Ape and a bunch of others. So, you know, it was a good run, amazing founders that I worked with.
Yeah. So when we're talking today about the evolution of Israeli gaming ecosystem, I don't think there's anybody better to talk about this.
And thank you.
The kind of the start that I wanted to, like when I wanted to kick off, is basically talking about how the gaming sector got started, because Israel has always been a very big hub for tech startups. You know, people might not know, but companies like Monday, Wix, Fiverr, Waze, just to mention a few of these sort of a consumer-focused startups, not to even mention all the B2B tech startups.
Yep.
And the area has not really been known before for massive gaming sector. But now you have, as you mentioned, Playtika, MoonActive, Playrium, Crazy Labs has been absolutely on a crazy tear. IronSource IPOing for, I believe, $8 billion. AppSly is there. Fiber is there. So the whole ecosystem is really booming. And now we're seeing these massive, massive corporations actually coming out of well, not coming, but evolving out of Israel. So what was the change and how this happened?
Yep. So I think that in a way I was lucky enough to be part of that change. And, you know, I'll talk about it in a second. But historically, the Israeli high tech, which started in the 80s of the 20th century, was mostly around the telecom and deep B2B, kind of deep tech, the things that came out of the military. And all the large companies that grew there were all, you know, dealing with sophisticated deep technology and almost not touching consumer. The first consumer successful startup out of Israel was ICQ, which was the first messenger, the first mega messenger over desktop. You know, could have been WhatsApp today, but got sold to AOL for, I think, kind of $400 million with phenomenal founders. And that started the move toward B2C. And as you mentioned, over the years, we've had like a crazy move to B2C, where now half the startups, if not more in Israel, are B2C companies. And some of them are kind of household names like Waze and Moovit and a bunch of others. Now, I think there's another part of Israeli high tech that people don't really know, which is sort of the precursor to the Israeli gaming ecosystem, which is that Israel had two additional sectors, consumer sectors, that became very large and very profitable, although maybe a little bit in the shadows. The first one is the online gambling market. And, you know, we can talk about that later, but Israel basically was the home of two of the most significant online gambling companies in the world. One of them is 888, an operator, and the other one is a company called Playtech, which is a software provider in the field. And the other one is the area of EdTech. And when I talk about EdTech, I don't talk just about companies like Kenshu that I invested in, which are platforms, but I'm talking about consumer-facing EdTech, or what was called in the past the toolbar world, where basically leveraging extensions and toolbars to distribute search for Google and for others, and to make money by acquiring many customers, consumers, and basically selling their data or access to their search to Google and others. And these two industries that are, you know, they were never at the top of international high tech. They were not really fancy industries, but each one of those is a multi-billion dollar industry, still are. And I basically moved into B2C around 2006 from a deep tech background and founding tech companies. I was offered to run 888, which is this large online gaming company traded today in London. And, you know, we can talk about the online gambling market, but in essence, I came in, and what became very apparent to me is that as a gamer, as somebody that played games ever since I was a kid, that it is very strange that we have all these capabilities in Israel. You know, we do game design, we do analytics, we do marketing, we do distribution, we do monetization, we do all these things, basically in both of these industries, in online gambling, and also in the toolbar world was a bit of that on, you know, in terms of acquiring customers and optimizing and monetizing. And still there's nobody building games. And so I started looking at it. I think that at the time there were only one or two Israeli games companies. We bought one into 888 in attempts to grow the company away from just online gambling into also games. And I started investing in companies in the field. And then one of these companies was basically Playtika, which was two founders that I knew from before. One of them actually worked in 888 many years ago. And another one that I knew from another company that dealt in mobile games. And we basically created Playtika together, not in attempts to build what Playtika is today, but in attempts to create games over social networks that are not Facebook, over secondary social networks. It's a long story. And then from Playtika, around Playtika, started growing more and more and more companies. And what happens in each one of the ecosystems that you'll see is that you see that whenever there is a large company that's being established, people start thinking it creates a hot center of something. And people start there. There are people that work in the company and go out and start companies. There are other people that never thought about games, but suddenly they see that there's all this money that's going into this company or that's coming out of this company. And so they suddenly start thinking about games. There are more and more people that are educated about it. And then that's how the ecosystem started. So basically, I think from the beginning of the crazy success of Playtika, which is kind of, you know, we founded Playtika in whatever, 2007 or 8, can't remember. And we sold it a year later. It was a crazy, crazy deal. And clearly a stupid deal as well, because it was, you know, today it's worth, I don't even want to say how many X what we sold it for, but let's say that it's 100X. And, but around this, around Playtika and its success, started growing this entire crazy ecosystem that is today probably together with Helsinki, probably the, you know, the hottest games ecosystem in the world.
Yeah, I would agree. And this is, so you touched upon on interesting things. And I like doing the comparison between Helsinki, because Israel and Finland are almost the same size of a countries in terms of population. Israel actually 7 million, if I'm correct.
We're 9.
Wow. Okay. Well, it was 7 when I last visited.
No. We're growing fast.
I was there last year, but... okay, so Israel is almost twice as big, but the ecosystems are very strong. And one of the things that back when I was in business school, I'm not going to say how many years ago that was, there was always comparison between Finland's tech ecosystem and Israel's, because Israel was producing a lot of new startups and they were selling really, really fast. And founders were exiting, but they were coming up with new stuff. And then Finland was kind of dominated by this one big thing, like you mentioned Playtika, but we had Nokia. And Nokia was kind of dominating everything, and Finns were going to work there, but we didn't have as strong of a culture of starting new companies. I don't know why, maybe there's no VCs and so forth. And I remember a lot of people from Israel were coming over and they were kind of looking at like, we need to build our Nokia. But now, and like, why are we selling so fast? Why are we not growing? And then kind of looking like, okay, 20 years passed since that moment, what I'm kind of seeing is like, now you have these ginormous billion-dollar companies, maybe not the size of a Nokia, but definitely large, large companies that are not being sold at the first turn of the event. Like, what was the catalyst for that?
I think that it's a great question, because for many years there was this kind of self-criticism that we're selling too early, and that and I think that to start with, we need to understand, and that's not really the case in the game industry, because in the game industry you can scale crazily fast as a standalone company, right? You know, the minute that your payback starts being good, you don't need that much money to continue scaling and scaling and scaling, because the money just comes back. What happens in other industries is that if you're, let's say that you're building a new route, you know, a new routing system for telecom, and let's say that you're getting to $10 million revenues, and let's say that Cisco is looking at your product and they know that on their channel, this is selling $1 billion without change. And so they're coming and they're offering you the price that would represent you selling for $100 million. And, you know, so let's say they offer you $500 million for your company. And the board comes to the CEO and says, okay, so, you know, what do you say? Should we sell or not? And the CEO says, I believe I can build a huge company. And they say, okay, great. But, this price is the price we would get when we would have $100 million revenues in the market. They're offering this price now. How sure are you that we're going to get to 100 million? And the poor CEO says, well, you know, I still need to recruit my head of sales, my CFO, my head of marketing, my this, my that, my... And then everybody looks and said, okay, so we're basically going to work for 4 or 5 years and potentially end up more or less at the same place with a lot of risk on the way. And so, first of all, we shouldn't blame companies that are sold when there's a clear distribution advantage to the larger company. As I said before, in games, it does not exist, because even if EA buys your game, yeah, they have a bit of databases, but it's nothing. At the end of the day, they're going to have to spend money on marketing it. And so, you know, in the past, again, when it was physical distribution to stores in games, then the big guys had a huge advantage, because, you know, how could I, as an indie developer, get to the stores of every PC games store in the world? I can't. EA can. So that was an advantage. But today, you know, my CMO in the tiny company and the CMO of VA basically spend money at the same place in Facebook or, you know, or in other platforms. And so, so first thing, in some domains, it is much clearer why people are selling early. That's one thing. The second thing is that usually when you look at these risks, there are some things that are very difficult to factor in. For example, how many experienced executives do you have in the country that you can recruit that are going to help you get there? So you need to have a head of sale. But if in your country, you can only get a head of sale that sold, you know, $15 or $20 million a year, and nobody that sold $500 million, how can you believe that you're going to get to $500 million if you don't have experienced marketing people? And so as the industry evolves, and as you're seeing more and more and more examples of successes, and as there are more executives coming from these examples of successes, you're getting to the point where many of these general risks are being diminished. And so the first thing is that as we had companies grow, you know, many of them fell through and sold, but as we had more companies grow, there are more people that believe they can, there are more people that have the capabilities, and so the risks are lower. That's one thing. The second thing that happened is that Israel started attracting a lot of growth capital, a lot more growth capital than I think any other ecosystem other than the United States. And it's much easier to decide to continue running forward if you can basically take $100 million into your company and know that the chances of you not succeeding are smaller because you've got the capital. More than that, I think that the international growth investors, a lot more than the Israeli ones, were always open to basically seeing some secondary taken out. And so when you say, okay, I have a company that's worth a few hundred million dollars, but that's on paper, and I still have a mortgage on my home, and somebody's coming and offering me to sell the company, you know, maybe I should sell it as the responsible thing for my kids and for everything else. Now, you know, the investors are coming in and saying, I'm going to put $100 million, but, you know, 10, 15 million out of it can be secondary for the founders and for the top employees that've been around for a long time. And so that is also the evolution of the ecosystem that allows this. And then the last thing is that we're having more and more and more of these companies led by second and third time founders. So when you look at a company like Monday, these are not first time founders. When you look at a company like Weeks, these are not first time founders, meaning that these are people that A, already believe that they can grow companies, but also usually have some home capital that allowed them to take more risks. So the combination of more examples of large companies that are guiding you to want that and to believe it's capable, more people coming out of these large companies with experience in your ecosystem, so you're not afraid that you can't find the right CMO or you can't find the right head of sales or whatever. More second and third time founders and more growth capital. These are the thing, the four components that allowed Israel. We call the last kind of 10 years Israel's evolution from startup nation to scale-up nation. Mm. That's how we like calling it. And luckily, I think that the new companies that grew here are not Nokias. You know, they're usually primarily digital, geographically independent, incredibly strong, global, you know, globally challenging companies that are basically going to be much stronger, I think, than a single company in a specific field.
Yeah.
And so we're very happy with the evolution of the ecosystem here.
Yeah, that's really interesting, kind of taking back like maybe 20 years of progress and what led here. So one thing that he mentioned was talent. And especially, well, in pretty much every tech, people are the key resource that makes you succeed. So how, you know, Israel probably has the most tech talent per square mile than any other country in the world. It's a relatively small size of a country. Yeah. So that also helps. But the population is still relatively small compared to all the tech companies and all the companies that exist in Israel that are scaling up in the scale up nation.
Yep.
So how do Israeli companies scale up effectively when there's such a competition where you have so many amazing startups that are not even startups anymore, that are basically IPOing like Playtika, yeah, and that are, yep, just on a crazy growth spurt? Like how do you manage talent there?
So it's actually a lot worse than this, because one more thing that Israel has that almost no other country in the world has, which has been so critical to Israel's growth, high-tech growth, is that we have here also more than 200 international development centers. Of companies like Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, and everybody else. The outcome is that not only do we compete on for talent between the startups, but we also compete against Amazon that have an AI research center here, or Microsoft that has 1,000 people here doing R&D, like the largest. I think that for Microsoft and for Google, for sure, this is the largest R&D center outside of the United States, and a very important one for both of them. They're like key products, not niche products. And so we're fighting here between the startups, and we're fighting between the startups and the large companies. And so basically a few things have happened. The first thing is that, I'll start from the end, the situation is not easy. So it's, I don't have a good answer to this, because many of my companies are struggling to recruit top talent. And this is just what I hear all across. And so yes, this is an issue. That's one thing. In this, there's a bunch of things that we're doing. The first thing is that there's constantly a push to continue getting kids to study science in general, science, STEM in school, and then computer science in university. And the numbers are growing, although not growing fast enough. That's one thing. The second thing is that there's a big government push with a lot of grants and stuff to help people convert to the right jobs. And so this is not about taking a window washer and turning them into a software architect, but this is about taking an electrical engineer and helping them get into the software business, because there's less demand right now. Well, maybe electrical engineers in the chip industry, but you know, a civil engineer or any other type of engineer, or somebody that has the capability, and move them into the Israeli tech. And there's lots of schools and lots of programs here that are doing this. That's the second thing. The third thing is that there are a bunch of programs, some of which I'm really involved in and have been involved from the beginning, where we're taking the parts of the Israeli population that are traditionally less involved in high tech, namely the ultra-Orthodox population. So we have more than a million ultra-Orthodox people in Israel that generally do not even study math and definitely not computer science in school. And they live a more religious type of life. And we basically created programs for them to start studying tech at the school level. And this is a huge change. We already have today thousands of new ultra-Orthodox Jews that are entering the job market. There, many of them, you know, some of them are also top engineers, but many of them have studied, web design or website building, or, but you know, the industry needs all, or QA, but the industry needs all of that. So, and we're growing this exponentially. So that's another area where we're growing from. Same thing with the Israeli Arab population. So the Israeli Arab population are what's called Palestinian citizens of Israel's. And they also traditionally were not a big part of the ecosystem, and we're pushing hard to give them an equal chance and, you know, give them programs to learn and help them being placed into top tech companies. And that's growing exponentially as well.
Yeah.
And having said all that, many Israeli companies at a certain point will make the move that we don't necessarily like, but is a must many times, of taking and splitting the core sophisticated tech tasks and keeping them in Israel. And then when you need tech extensions, when you need more work on tech art, or when you need more work on other things, you'd see many of these companies have offices in Eastern Europe or in India, mostly in Eastern Europe, because there's a big advantage in Israel, because there's lots of people that speak Russian because of the big wave of Russian immigration into Israel in the 90s. And so you'd see all these companies that we spoke about, Playtika, Plarium, MoonActive, all of them would have centers in Eastern Europe. And these centers would, differs between the companies, but these centers would basically enhance some of the core work that's being done in Israel.
Yeah. And one of the things that, so this is just my own experience. I mean, I've for the listeners to know, I've had family in Israel for a long time, and I've been visiting many times. So it's not new to me. But when I went there last year with my wife, she's a fan. Her perception of Israel was very different than what the reality was. And then when she arrived to Tel Aviv, she was kind of surprised that this is a normal beach city with very great restaurant scene, with great bars. And
it's not a normal beach city. It's the best beach city in the world. What do you mean? Without COVID, we have the best weather, the best food, the best looking people, parties, the best DJs.
For sure. I would say Miami has something to offer as well. But anyway, like she was extremely surprised And that's not something, and it allowed me kind of to see from somebody else's perspective of what they consider Israel being. And yep. Does that affect specialists not moving to Israel? Because their perception might be something totally different. I don't know what she was thinking about, but she's like a blonde lady and she thought it would be like a total, like the most Middle Eastern stereotype you can find. And she kind of thought that she was traveling there.
How come when I go into Uber, there's not a camel option? I've seen that before.
Exactly. And she was kind of like, and I was like, don't worry, there's a lot of diversity there. Like you won't stand out at all.
So look, I think that, you know, Israel is very, very unique in many things. And clearly, you know, we're not going to go into geopolitical stuff, I think, in this podcast, but clearly not a simple place. However, it's been now a few years that we finally, it took us years to do that, but we finally convinced the government that there needs to be an expert visa for people that want to come and spend time in Israel. And it's kind of funny because for years, the government didn't do anything about it because the assumption was that nobody would ever want to come. Why would anybody want to come to the Middle East, you know, from their home country? And now we have these visas and there are thousands of people that are coming here. You know, at the beginning, maybe it was more Jewish people that had relatives, but now it's all across and people are coming and spending a year or two here. It's clearly very far from home for many people. So, you know, it's not as simple as living in New York and moving to the Valley. It is farther, but we are seeing a growing trend that clearly now COVID stopped a little bit. We have seen a growing trend of international experts that are looking at the top companies here and are saying, wow, if I can get a job in one of these companies, I would love moving over. Good weather, good food, great ecosystem. And it's kind of, you know, it's funny, you mentioned Miami and many people mention Miami in regards to Tel Aviv. The only thing is that if you want to be in the tech ecosystem, going to Miami is like death. There's nothing, right? So basically Tel Aviv is this very unique place where you can really do what we Israelis love doing most, which is work hard in the morning and play hard at night, right? So we have the best startups, but we also have the best parties.
Yeah,
and that's kind of unique with good weather, with nice people. Everybody's welcome.
All right. So enough with the ads. Let's not tell everybody how awesome the city is. I still like the hotel prices are high as it is already.
But it is.
So let's talk a little bit about the characteristics of the ecosystem, the gaming ecosystem of Israel. So I will compare it a little bit, not compare, but I will give a little bit notion of what the ecosystem is like in Helsinki. And it is very collaborative. It's hard even to imagine that it would be rival in the sense that people do share a lot of information, trying to help each other. Even the companies who have already sold to bigger companies, you still can meet up with almost anybody. You can discuss things. They will share very actionable insights in what you should be looking at and what you should be doing because everybody's kind of trying to help each other. And in that sense, I've worked both here and I work both in Bay Area. And I do have to say in Bay Area, it is competitive. It's not even rival. It's just straight up competitive. You can't talk to anybody. And I do have to say that this collaborative environment is quite nice. It seems like there's more knowledge and it's very easy to get. How is it like in Israel? Like, is it rival? Is it competitive? Is it collaborative?
It's a good question. And I think that we're probably somewhere in the middle. I think that in general, we're a lot more collaborative than the competitive nature of Silicon Valley or New York. And we definitely see companies sharing information, especially if they're not directly competing. And then I think that the very large companies, the ones that are very successful and are, you know, continuing on their growth trajectory, in general, they are a lot more sensitive to their secretive information. They're a lot more sensitive to sharing. They're a lot more sensitive to their trade secrets, if you wish. And so I don't think you'd see, sessions where the large, you know, billion-dollar companies or multi-billion-dollar companies in Israel meet startups to help them. You know, they would meet them to see if they want to invest. They would meet them to see if they want to publish the game. They would meet them for that. But they were very, it would be very rare, I think, to see them really openly give them advice. unless it's completely non-competitive. So, you know, I think that, you know, Playtika, if somebody came with a AAA idea, Playtika would share whatever they know, but it, you know, it's directly not competing. Yeah. But if somebody came with something that is even close, and Playtika today is, you know, it touches almost any genre in mobile, I think that, it would be tough to get a lot of help. The rest of the industry, the smaller companies are very collaborative. There's a lot of meetups and events, and people share their successes and failures, and there are a bunch of industry groups. And I definitely get a lot of questions and try to help wherever I can. It still feels like a kind of a new industry in Israel, despite the fact that it's been around now for more than 10 years, very successful. But it still feels new. It still feels like a bit of outsiders. You know, it's like we don't mix that much with the heavy tech people. I mean, I invest in everything, but, you know, the game people don't mix that much with the heavy tech people. And I think that we're kind of enjoying right now the fact that, at least on the B2C side, because of the major success and because people are starting to understand what a complex task it is to build a successful game company, we're seeing more and more people that are saying about learning from the game industry into other industries, which I think is the smartest. I mean, for years now, I've been asking my game CEOs as a favor to send them CEOs of other non-games B2C companies for a day or two. And, the CEOs come with their head twisted, swirling, and they're like, we do two tests a week or a month, and we thought that's okay. These guys are doing two tests an hour. I mean, how can they even live? We have, we have 10 data points on the customer every month. They have the 10 data points on the customer every 5 minutes. So I am trying to leverage that. The industry is in a good place. And so people are helping each other.
Yeah. It's especially with, I understand. So industry is in a good place, but let's talk about, there's a lot of people from outside Helsinki and outside Tel Aviv listening. And they, like, what has gone right in terms of the evolution of ecosystem and what we're sort of challenging, because a lot of other ecosystems or clusters, however you want to put it, are maybe a decade away where Tel Aviv and Helsinki are now. So in your experience, like, what are the certain things to watch for, and what are the certain things to double down on?
Yeah. So, I'll go back to something that I think we spoke about in the previous podcast, which is, we can characterize right now games into creative-led games and data and kind of optimization, monetization-led games. And clearly, all games, if people didn't hear it before, every game has both. But you definitely can see that our companies where what's leading is the creative and the game design. And then they usually are not as good on monetization. They're not as good on optimization, and they need to add that with time. And then on the other hand, you see companies that come from data, come from optimization, come from monetization, where in a way the data almost dictates the direction of the product, right? And when you look at, you want to give examples. So, Supercell would be an easy example of a creative-led company. Again, from what I can see from the outside and from knowing Ilka and the guys. And on the other hand, Playtika would be a very much numbers data-driven company. And it's always kind of funny because when I talk to some senior people in Supercell, I can tell them, if we bring the top data people from Playtika into your company, they could double your revenues and profit, which is probably true. But then when I talk to the Playtika people, I tell them, if I bring the top creative people from Supercell into your company, on top of everything great that you're doing with data and optimization, we can probably double that company as well, right? So it's that's the beauty of a game. It's a mixture of science and art. It's a mixture of creative and data. Israel has made a tremendous progress, and it's probably the leading place in the world by far, from my perspective, on the data-driven optimization and monetization of games. There's no other company in the world that I'm aware of, clearly not the large ones, but even kind of the rising stars, that is as good at looking at data, optimizing it, running algorithms on it, deciding how to personalize, deciding what to offer, deciding when to do it, deciding how to do it, compared to the Israeli games companies. Nothing even comes close to that. And this has been the stronghold of Israeli game industry, and why, by the way, it also attracted a lot more capital, I think, in recent years than many other game industries, simply because it is easier to count on something that is the science part of it, right? It's tough sometimes to invest in creative. It's easier to invest in the science. On the other hand, maybe the area where Israel didn't yet make the full quantum leap is on having the creative side of it catch up with the same skills. And so when we look at, and clearly I'm now slightly exaggerating, and to make my point, you know, when you look at a company like Plarium, you know, where Raid is now their biggest game, that is a very creative heavy game, right? That's a phenomenal game that I love.
Jelly Button is pretty creative as well.
Exactly. And so, you know, so there are elements, but in general, if I needed to rank, I'd say that the game industry sucked a lot of the talent when it comes to machine learning, data mining, optimization. And we have some of the best people in Israel sitting in the game companies in this. And then on the other hand, because we don't have a strong creative industry in Israel, you know, we don't do television for the rest of the world. We don't do movies for the rest of the world. I think that a creative bit still has room for improvement. I always said that if we, you know, if we took the Helsinki ecosystem, which is creative driven, and the, you know, the Israel ecosystem, and we merged it, we would have taken over the entire industry. Or maybe it would have blown up and there would be nothing. I don't know, yeah. One of the two. So the creative element is one thing. And the outcome of this is that the genres that have evolved in Israel are usually, the genres that were very successful in Israel are the genres that are usually less creative heavy. I mean, I'm not undermining them in any way. They're entertaining billions of people around the world. You know, Moon Active is entertaining, you know, tens of millions of people a day. It's great. But in general, when you look at the areas, you know, we're strong on casual. We're strong on hyper-casual. We're strong on social casino. We're strong or strong-ish on mid-core. But we don't really have any AAA company.
Yeah.
We don't really have any indie strong console company. Okay. We don't have any strong VR, you know, if you look at the future, VR gaming company. Because these areas are usually more creative led. And so that's an area that the industry has not evolved.
Yeah. And that's probably why Israel is, especially when you think about the most successful companies, they have a strong social casino portfolio. And that's probably the reason, because, you know, well, you know, but people might not know that social, the casino is not, it's illegal in Israel.
Yeah, we don't have gambling in Israel.
Yeah, so it is really weird that the best casino and gambling companies come from a place that don't even have.
I'm not even sure it's that weird, because I think Israelis are very good to identify opportunities and jump at them. And so when you know, the casino started in Israel with 888 and Playtech. With, you know, some very quick founders that identified the trend and jumped on. I don't think they were the first in the world, but they were amongst the first in the world, and they jumped on the trend and delivered huge value quickly. And then I think that social casino was sort of an offspring of that. So we had people that knew slot machines, we had people that knew what are the monetization elements and so on, more than in other countries because of that, these companies. And so that's how social casino started. But, you know, and I think it's also fair to say that, you know, Playtika right now is probably half social casino when you look at it, you know, with all the acquisitions and all the new things. Plarium is zero social casino, right?
It's strategy
and RPG, and a little bit of casual. Moon Active, yeah, you know, the number one game has like one third of the game is luck based. It's a slot. But basically the unique thing in it is mostly the social interaction and the meta game around it. And so I don't think that social casino is the main driver here, but clearly it's overweight in Israel compared to the weight of social casino in the world.
Yeah. And if you consider Helsinki, for example, or Finland overall, we have totally legal gambling. You can find slot machines in every store. It's totally normal. Nobody's going crazy about them because it's like a toilet. And, we actually have two, I mean, it's as normal, but we have two social casino companies actually with a physical presence as well as web-based, but they're governmental owned, and there's no startups that were making casino games, even though we have a lot of casino publishers, a lot of slot machine experts, a lot of poker, like all these experts exist, yet nobody is doing anything worldwide. So that's why I said it was kind of interesting, like we have the capabilities, yet Israel is the one that is actually succeeding in social casino. So before I let you go, kind of like the last question would be is like, how do you see the gaming ecosystem continue to evolve in Israel? Like what is the path? More data driven Are you going to have creatives that are going to explode the whole market?
So I think that there's going to be a bunch of things that are going to happen. The first thing that's going to happen is that the data-driven approach is going to continue driving growth and success. I think that that's basically, you know, like if you say that Market Recent said that software is eating the world, I think that data is eating the game industry. And I think that those that are left behind, you know, we're going to see less and less companies that succeed despite not being deep on their data, that succeed despite not having the best optimization. That's going to be, there will be companies like, there's always going to be somebody that's going to be so creative that it's going to work. But these are going to be less and less and farther and farther apart. And so Israel, you know, based on this building block of data, I think that Israel is going to continue to thrive and we're going to continue seeing companies like that grow. That's one thing. Second thing is that we're going to see these companies continue acquiring companies in a crazy pace. And the reason is that once you have the infrastructure for that, then you look at other people's games and you see the money on the floor, right? So you look at games that don't monetize well or are not balanced well or not using data correctly. And you're like, okay, they're making $100,000 a day, but I can easily see $300,000 a day without spending more money. They're just not doing everything I know it should be done. And so that's why Playtika acquired so many companies and will continue acquiring. And I think that the other companies in the field will start acquiring companies. And so that's the second thing. So, and many of these are going to be outside of Israel, which means that the Israeli game companies are going to become like, you know, octopus with lots of, you know, lots of arms in many places. And then the last thing is that I think that with time and on the same strong basis of data, all the CEOs of all the companies want to move and open their realm more to more creative-led games. I don't think we're going to see Playtika or any of the other companies that are data-driven, data-based, kind of give away the data element and the optimization element and say, let's just build creative games. I don't think that's going to happen. These projects will just die because they're so different from the company DNA. But I do see and start hearing that there's a lot more intention to develop these kind of games in Israel or elsewhere based on the same infrastructure. And I think if anybody's listening and they have a great idea for a game, you know, these are good times to talk to the strong Israeli companies and ask them if they want to develop them together, because it's, you know, if you've got very creative, the Israeli companies can make it very successful. So I think that's the way it's going to evolve.
I think on that note, thank you, Gigi, so much for coming in again on the podcast. And as always, we'll have you anytime, whatever topic you want to talk about.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.